You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast produced by Veteran Strategies and featuring conversations with fascinating and impactful men and women who have shaped our world, our communities, and our history. My name is Robert Vane, principal of Veteran Strategies, and your host for our discussion. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction, the Crown Plaza Hotel, Grand Hall, and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney, and Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. You can find all your sales and rental equipment needs fulfilled at McAllister.com. We are pleased to announce our podcast is now a member of the All Indiana Podcast Network in partnership with Wish TV. You can find Leaders and Legends at AllIndianaPodcastNetwork.com. Thank you for joining us on the Leaders and Legends podcast. Our guest today is Notre Dame great, All-American, and recipient of one of the most famous passes in the history of Notre Dame football. And we'll talk about the Snow Bowl before our time is up. Mr. Reggie Brooks, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an honor. As someone, as we were talking before we started recording, as a Catholic kid from Indiana, I remember my father rooting like crazy for Notre Dame, and I remember games when I was a kid, but it was really your era, in the era of slightly a few years ahead of you, when Notre Dame came back, that reignited what Notre Dame football meant, not only to the state, but also to people around the country. I'm very excited to talk to you. I'm almost giddy, I would have to say. And the first thing I wanted to ask you is, as I was reading through your biography and watching clips on YouTube and various things, is I was struck that you went to Notre Dame. You're from Oklahoma. That's not a bad football school, not a bad football state. How did you matriculate to South Bend, Indiana? And if you want to address this as well, how did your older brother, Tony, matriculate to Notre Dame, Indiana?
Well, it really started with him and my dad. So, you know, my brother was Gatorade Player of the Year for the state of Oklahoma. So he was being recruited, you know, by everybody in the United States, very highly touted. And Oklahoma was like really on him hard, in particular Barry Switzer. I remember Barry Switzer coming to my mom's job, you know, trying to woo her to get my brother to come to Notre Dame. And, you know, it, for all intents and purposes, you know, we were thinking he's going to wind up at Oklahoma or Oklahoma State at the least. So, you know, you get like back then you got like all the mail, and he used to get bags and bags of mail that'd be dropped off. And it was kind of funny because my dad was a postal worker, a postman. So, you know, he would get, he would see it when he'd go to work, get all the, you know, see all the mail, and, you know, the guys would rib him about, man, your son, he's the man. But I remember Tony, like, so he would kind of go through the mail again, you know, Michigan, you know, Penn State, you got USC, UCLA, Miami, you know, you name it across the country. He's being recruited by, you know, LSU, Alabama, Texas. So, you know, he would always read the Oklahoma mail because we grew up, you know, Oklahoma fans, you know, the Wishbone and everything like that. But he picked up you know, we didn't know where Notre Dame was. I mean, you know, really had no concept of it.
Well, but when you were being recruited, Notre Dame was terrible. And Oklahoma just won a national championship. Was it
85,
yeah.
And so, you know, we were going, and he was about to toss the Notre Dame letter to the side, and my dad saw it. And so he starts telling us about all the history of Notre Dame and, you know, the Gipper and Rockne, and we're like, who the hell are these people? We had no clue.
Did they tell you that the current president of the United States at the time had played George Gipp in the movie?
Of course. I mean, you know, he gave us the full, like, and we're still like, okay, we had no idea where Notre Dame was. And then we watched the game. Again, it was not a great outcome. But what struck us was the, you know how they came in with the cameras and it shone on the dome. And it just looked like this mystical place. And, you know, tied it in with what my dad was always hyping and said, you know, this is a great institution. They have great history. And my dad was a big proponent of the history of the game. So right. He made us, you know, study the history of the game and know the different, you know, aspects. And, you know, when Notre Dame, you know, even Leahy, you know, he talked about, you know, the going 4 years in a row and not losing a game. And, you know, we're thinking, okay, you know, this, you know, there's some, you know, lore and legend from a history standpoint. He started naming off the Heisman Trophy winners. So it piqued our interest. But, you know, Oklahoma was still the top winner. So it was actually when this is before this was not legal, but you know, Coach Holtz had some of the donors, some of the alumni at Notre Dame from Notre Dame that lived in Tulsa to come and film some of my brother's games, and then he would ship them back to South Bend so guys could look at them. And you know, lo and behold, we find out that some of the more prominent donors at Notre Dame lived in Tulsa. And, you know, being from North Tulsa, it was a very, you know, Tulsa was fairly segregated. So you had the South side and North side, and North side was, you know, not a lot of opportunities there. Again, the high school we went to was pretty much a prominent one. So as we're, you know, learning more, we're starting to see, you know, a lot of the, you know, high profile individuals that we knew around Tulsa, they wind up being Notre Dame alumni, which was like, oh, wow. So, you know, and that was one of the things that, you know, kind of struck us, just the value and how widespread Notre Dame's name was and the fact that it had such an impact on my dad. And, you know, he was like singing the praises of Notre Dame because of its history.
Even though the drive from Tulsa to Oklahoma to Norman must have been, you know, it couldn't have been that long, I'm guessing. A few hours, maybe, or less.
A couple hours there. Now it's like an hour and like 15 minutes because you can, the speed limit is much higher.
So your parents or your father pushed Notre Dame, even though they knew, hey, we may not be able to see every game because it's so far away.
Well, now that was the other thing. So when, you know, that was kind of the thought, because it was like a 13-14 hour drive from Tulsa to South Bend. And, you know, we, you know, didn't have a lot of money. And, you know, that's why we were going to go to school, was through athletic scholarship. We did go to a prominent high school, Magnet High School, that was recognized nationally academically. So we had and that was the one thing that, again, that helped us with Notre Dame, is that, you know, Notre Dame being an educational institution, and us having a background in education. And that was the one big thing for my mom, is that as long as my babies get a good education, she care less where we went to school, just make sure you get that degree.
But did you get the sense, before we move on, did you get the sense that your parents knew, and or Coach Holtz made it clear, that a degree from Notre Dame is just different?
Exactly. And it didn't hurt when Barry Switzer went to my mom's job and basically said, what is it going to take for your son to get come to Oklahoma? And that really upset her, because she was like, you can't buy my children. And that pretty much nixed Oklahoma from being in any – having any opportunity, because again, as much as my dad, you know, pushed Notre Dame, it was my mom. She ruled the roost, and you know, so her word was law. And you know, he had her sold on Notre Dame. And then when Coach Holtz came into the living room, that little fella is magical. I mean, he did the magic tricks. Was talking to her mom and my mom and dad, and you know, I mean, he had them wrapped up pretty quickly. And even then, my brother was like, yeah, I'm still going to go somewhere where I can go party.
And then what happened?
My mom. She's like, you're not going to Oklahoma. And, you know, Lou Holtz, because he said, hey, you know, you're gonna play high-level football again. At the time, Notre Dame wasn't doing – and he was really his first recruiting class.
Right. Yeah, was him, Tony. Right.
Tony, Ricky Waters, Todd Light, you know, Boo Williams. So it was a number of guys. And that was the pitch. You're going to come play at a high level of football, but you're going to get an education from a well-renowned institution. And he kept pressing that issue, and that's what sold my mom. My dad was sold from the giddy up because of the lore and the history of Notre Dame.
So Cole Schultz, your brother Tony, is he 2 years older than you or 1 year older?
Two.
2 years older. So he comes to recruit Tony successfully. Tony goes on to Notre Dame to be a star player by every measure. So were you in the room and involved in your older brother Tony Brooks's recruiting process? I mean, were you allowed to kind of, quote, hang around, for lack of a better term? And during that period, did Holt say, Reggie, I'm coming back for you, so don't you go anywhere? Or was it kind of like, hey, I'm going to go where my brother goes?
No, for me, it was more of, again, I didn't really get a chance to, you know, be honest with you, I really didn't want to hang out because, again, that didn't really resonate with me. I was just trying to make the team as a high school player. And at the time, mm-hmm. in the spring, I was focused on track. I ran track, so I was kind of doing my own thing. And be honest with you, I was kind of like thinking more, that's his deal, that's for him. Mm-hmm. And at the time, like I said, Notre Dame wasn't very good, so I'm like, not wasn't really feeling Notre Dame personally. But as you know, he went, and then we would go up, and like you said, it was a trek.
Mm-hmm.
But after my games in high school on Friday nights, we would leave Friday night after the game and drive up to South Bend overnight. My dad and a good family friend of ours, we had this van. We'd climb in the van and make that trek, and we would get there early in the morning, go find the hotel, and, go to the game. And that was kind of our ritual. But me going back and actually going to the games and getting to meet some of the players, but also the atmosphere, a fall at Notre Dame is like no other.
That's beautiful.
So I had the opportunity to kind of experience Notre Dame from a fan perspective and just be able to take in the atmosphere of a game and not having been kind of pressed to get ready for a game.
But you stayed on Holtz's radar. Is it? Forgive me. You stayed on Holtz's radar, right? Like he was aware of you, mm-hmm. and he thought. So by the time you started entertaining college choices, the whole, well, Notre Dame's not that good right now, that was out the window.
Exactly. They had just won a national championship my senior year, and that carried a lot of weight with me. But at the same time, you had several guys on the team that I'd gotten to know through my brother. And, so I had a familiarity with the program and how they did things. It wasn't a foregone conclusion because at the time, Oklahoma State had Barry Sanders and he was on his way out. He was leaving early as junior year. And I was feeling Oklahoma State because they ran the I formation. It was very similar to the system I ran in high school. And we would go down there quite a bit. And I knew a lot of guys that came from my high school played at Oklahoma State. So there was Oklahoma was out because, again, what happened with my mom and Barry Switzer. But Oklahoma State was still very much in the picture for me my senior year just because of, the proximity. And, I was kind of a mama's boy. So, staying home close to home was not – that, it was something, again, I felt Tony was going to leave no matter what. He was getting away from home.
Is my memory failing me, but would you have been at Oklahoma State the same time as Thurman Thomas?
No. So Thurman Thomas was before Barry.
So he's so before Thurman, Barry Switzer. Mm-hmm. Barry Sanders, excuse me.
So
yeah.
And Thurman was, like I said, I remember my eighth grade year going into ninth grade, went to the one of the Oklahoma State camps and had the opportunity to meet Thurman, and was always cool because, like I said, when I finally made it to the league, you know, he was one of the guys when we played Buffalo or I'd see him around. Mm-hmm. He always remembered me from the time when, like I said, he was a senior and I was going into the ninth grade. He was at the camp and one of the guys that would talk to, they were recruiting my brother at the time, mm-hmm. a junior, but, you know, he did make some time for me and we, you know, always had a mutual respect for each other because he was one of those guys that I looked up to coming out of high school.
If you had to describe Lou Holtz, I'll give you three words, just three. Which three would you use?
Intense, demanding, and impatient.
Impatient for improvement, impatient based on behavior. What did you win?
Period. I mean, this guy could go from 0 to 100 in a matter of seconds. And what I mean by that is, like, you could be having a conversation and you're getting coached up, and if something goes just slightly out of what he feels it should go, oh my gosh, he just explodes. He was not very patient when it came to, you know, making mistakes. And this is in practice, let alone a game. I mean, so, but that intensity and that drive to say, hey, he was always looking for that perfect practice. And he was very demanding, I mean, constantly. He was pressuring you, pushing you, demanding more of you in practice. So when we got to the games, that was a break. You know, we got to a game, we could actually relax at a game versus practice.
I think players have said that. We had Ray Tolbert, if you've ever heard of Ray Tolbert. He was a captain of Indiana University's 1981 national championship team. Mr. Basketball in here in Indiana, first round draft pick. He said that. He goes, man, games were easy compared to practices under Coach Knight. Like, we couldn't wait to actually get out there to play because, you know, then we could kind of do our own thing within the, you know, framework of a team concept. He goes, but man, in practice, he's constantly stopping it. And, you know, Coach Knight's known to be a little excitable.
So Lou would like, so we'd do 24 periods. So it was 24 periods of 5 minutes per period. So 2 hour practice. And so you would go, and they said there was, you know, practice was scripted out from individual, I mean, even from warm up. So calisthenics to individual to one-on-ones to 707 to indoor, and in certain pockets he would have, like, we always had two special teams periods of 15 minutes per, so 30 minutes of the practice was focused on special teams. So you get to a point in practice where we would get to inside run mostly, because he was, you know, he always said, three things can happen when you throw the ball and two of them are bad. So he would really focus in on the run game. And if that's not going well, everybody's going to be miserable. So he would either roll practice periods back. So you can get to practice period 14, and he would take you all the way back to period 6. And you're starting from period 6, like you go all the way to 14, go back to period 6 or 8, and then you have to go get to 24. So many a day we were late getting out of practice because, again, he was that demanding, and he would make things, you know, he would always run it again. And this one play I will never forget is, and I had to be crazy or something, but we were full pads and we ran a play and the right guard messed up the play and we got tackled in the backfield. He just freaking lost it. get him out of here. He got told the right guard to get out. And so the offensive line coach is going to put in the backup. He's like, no, we're going to run it without him because it's like he wasn't even there in the first place. So we're in full pads in that, grant you. And the defense knows what play we're running, and we're missing the right guard. And I run the play. Oliver Gibson is the nose tackle. And he comes off and literally almost knocks me out. I'm literally looking out of my ear hole. just blasting me. And it's like, and I think back now, it's like, why would I run that play knowing the outcome? And it just, you would find yourself doing things that you wouldn't normally do because, you know, you wanted to make sure that you did your very best. And again, it was for the guys you played with, your teammates. You know, how do you do better for them? And this is practice. But I know one thing, I never had to worry about that in the game.
Well, let me ask you one more question about kind of Holtz and recruiting. You know, you've read a lot of recruiting pitches. And one of the things that I read when I read recruiting stories about Notre Dame players is that the coaches and the folks talking to prospective Irish say, look, this is a 40-year decision. Like, I know you don't understand now, but you will understand how this is going to impact your life for the rest of your life. You won't just play and then leave. Did that come true? Are you a living embodiment of that recruiting promise?
I would say so. And Coach Holtz was very big on, and he'd tell you, you know, a lot of you guys, but this is after you've signed your letter of intent, so I don't know how. So he'd tell us, like I said, first, you know, when the freshman, freshman would come in a week before the upperclassmen, and he said, a lot of you guys are not going to like me, a lot of you guys are going to hate me, but you will thank me when you get that degree. And 18, 19 years old, you're like, yeah, whatever. I'm here to play football. Mm-hmm. But it has been such a blessing because I almost left Notre Dame. After my sophomore year, I was frustrated, wasn't getting opportunities. It was, you know, the cultural differences really, you know, impacted me coming from North Tulsa to, you know, South Bend, Indiana, which I knew nothing about. It was very difficult, and just the transition, because I didn't grow up Catholic, and Notre Dame was very Catholic. But my dad was like, you made that commitment, you're going to stick with it. And I'm so glad that he forced me to grow up. And you're going to have challenges, you're going to have, you know, things happen. But the thing about Notre Dame that I always remember is, you know, people cared for you. You cared for those, cared for your teammates, but you were required to go through some things that were difficult, but it lets you know you can overcome a lot if you have people that genuinely care for you and want the best for you. And I can go anywhere in the country, and in some cases the world, and if I'm wearing that interlocking MD, there's an instant connection that people will acknowledge, connect with, and communicate to you what, you know, were you from Notre Dame? And I'm literally in 10th, and this is 2009, I believe. I'm in Tanzania, Africa, and would go out, was, you know, kind of going back and forth, went out with my Redskin gear on one day, you know, played with the Redskins. Nobody gave me a second look. A couple of days later, I had on a Notre Dame hat and was out in the market, and these guys came up to me, Notre Dame. Didn't speak a lick of English, but they knew that interlocking MD. And that really hit home for me, is like, wow, this is a worldwide brand like no other.
Did your brother and Coach Holtz know that you were considering leaving the school, or is it just something you confided with your family, your dad?
My brother did. And I hadn't, I called my dad before I was going to go see Coach Holtz, and that pretty much nixed that meeting after talking to my dad. So I was like, I'm just going to have to figure this out.
And what would Coach Holtz have said to you, do you think, if you had gone to see him?
Oh, probably the same thing. It's like, hey, you know, I'm going to continue to challenge you. And he probably would have given me my walking papers. Because, again, if you were not mentally tough, you're not going to survive under Coach Holtz. Plain and simple. If you did not have the mental fortitude to deal with the pressure that you were going to be under, we were under pressure mentally and physically, was a constant.
And this was a question I was going to ask you later on in the podcast, but I'll ask you about it now. Do you think one of the reasons why Coach Holtz may have just said, okay, Mr. Brooks, you do what you got to do, I'll do what I need to do, is because of the amazing talent that Notre Dame had in the backfield and on offense in those years. And I think one of the most remarkable aspects of your career is how you stood out and did so well in a backfield with people like Jerome Bettis.
Well, that was a good thing about it. It's like, you know, you had such a respect and, you know, it was a joy to play with Jerome. And then, like I said, it was funny because, like I said, our backfield, and I think, I don't know if this is still true to this day, but we were the all-rookie backfield in the NFL in 93. So myself, mm-hmm. Jerome, and Rick Meyer were the two rookie running backs and the rookie quarterback that were on the all-rookie team coming out. And that's not by coincidence. I mean, you know, we know about Jerome and his, you know, legendary capabilities and his ability, you know, just – he's just not only a phenomenal football player, but a phenomenal person. Rick Meyer, and I always said, I think, of all the things, I love Coach Holtz, but I think, again, had Rick had a more pass-oriented offense and someone that knew the passing game a little more focused on it, he would have been phenomenal. But did pretty good and is doing pretty good, doing well for himself now. But that started because we were behind Tony Rice, Rodney Culver, Ricky Waters, my brother, Anthony Johnson. So if you were going to succeed, you had to step your game up. And like you said, we were so deep in the backfield. You know, that's one of the reasons, again, Dorsey Levins was in our class, and he decided to go to Georgia Tech.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think it worked out for him well, and he's still, to this day, a very good friend. But just the talent and the competitiveness of that backfield was unparalleled.
You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction, the Crown Plaza Hotel, Grand Hall, and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney, and Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinley's Golden Ace Inn, and the Irish at the best Irish bar in the state. The Golden Ace are going to be loving this podcast for sure. And McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. Our guest today on the Leaders and Legends podcast is a Notre Dame legend, All-American Reggie Brooks. You were a senior in high school when Notre Dame won the 1988 national championship. What was it like to watch that season? Maybe you got to go to a game or two, but to watch that season unfold, given Coach Holtz's visits to your older brother, Tony, and Notre Dame wasn't that good. And here they are, two years later, Holtz's third season, and they are rolling. They beat number one Miami and what's probably the greatest game in Notre Dame history, or certainly very close.
They beat Michigan.
I'm going to ask you about that. They beat Michigan on a bunch of Reggie Holt field goals. They beat number two USC at USC, and then they beat West Virginia in the Fiesta Bowl, and they were ranked number three. Holtz comes and visits. Notre Dame's not all that great. Just a couple of years later, they're the talk of the country. What was it like to watch that season, and what was it like to talk to your brother about that season?
It was magical. I mean, you know, said my brother was one of the leading rushers on the team at the time. And again, I had the opportunity the year before. So and to see how this team came together and got to see the players, and you know, and people talk about the offense, but that defense was pretty darn good too. You had Wes Pritchard, Ned Bocar, Michael Stonebreaker, Boo Williams, Chris Zorich. I mean, you look at that defense, and that was the one of the things I said. I had the opportunity to go up and watch a few practices in the spring, and just the intensity of the practices. And this is spring ball, and you're talking about thumping. I mean, they were going after it, and they would do ones versus ones. Wow. And, you know, you look at that offensive line, you had Chuck Lonza, you know, you had Andy Hack, then Tim Grunhardt, Dean Brown. I mean, they had some horses up front, and just watching those offensive defensive lines go at it, I mean, that was something to see.
You said you were at the famous 31-30 victory, I think it's at October 15th, 1988, where Notre Dame beats Jimmy Johnson and the I don't know if powerhouse is quite the term, but it's pretty darn close and maybe understates it. Defending national champion Miami Hurricanes. It's the subject of a 30 for 30, which is available on your Amazon if you want to watch it, called Catholics versus Convicts, that centers on a t-shirt, controversial t-shirt that was part of the lore that day and ever since. But the game itself is absolutely magnificent. And you were in the crowd.
I actually got it. And again, I was there on an unofficial visit. You know, I got to come again, like I said, we would, we play Friday nights and hop in the van and drive all night to get up to South Bend to watch the game. And so I had the opportunity to be on the sideline when the fight broke out, which just was
the pregame fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the tunnel, I mean, that got you so hyped, because that was the thing about Miami, was very much about intimidation. You know, they would come in and, you know, just say, hey, we're going to take control and show you that, you know, we're physically, and try to psych you out. That was not going down that game. And it was funny because I remember, you know, Rocky Abismal, great return man and great receiver, getting there fighting and scrapping it up, Tony Rice. And I'm like, wow, that's the quarterback of Notre Dame. And nobody was backing down. And that just set the tone for that game.
I think everybody's trying to get behind Zorich. Like, Zorich, you just take on that whole team. I think you'll be fine.
But that's the thing about it. It was like T. Rice was like right out front, you know, Stance Magala. It was like, and again, you knew what Miami was trying to do. They were trying to intimidate the Notre Dame team. Because, again, about a couple of years before, you know, Miami had throttled Notre Dame like 58-6 or some crazy number. And, you know, they were thinking that this is the same soft team. No, completely different mindset, completely different focus. And there was just this intensity. And be honest with you, that really lit a fire under Notre Dame and saying, okay, you think you're going to come in our house? There's no way.
Had you decided, you said it was an unofficial visit, so you hadn't committed yet, if I'm getting this correct. So how much, or if, did that one game solidify your Notre Dame choice?
It had a major impact. Because again, seeing, for me, it was always about the team. And to see guys come together for a common bond, a common goal, just really resonates with me. You know, just seeing guys saying, hey, we're not about, you know, one person or a couple of stars. This is about us being there for us and setting the tone of, because football to me is the consummate team sport. It requires 11 guys, whether you're offense or defense, to execute at a high level and to be on the same page to have success. And that requires 11 people working together constantly. Each play requires 11 guys to bond together, come together, and execute a play. And, you know, for those 6 to 7, 6 to 8 seconds, everybody in unison, it just, there's something about that that just resonates with my spirit that says, when you can do that, when you have people that are that willing to get outside of themselves and focus in on the bigger picture and step up and, you know, like an offensive lineman, you know, they're not there to be seen. They're there to block. And, you know, it's not about them, you know, and for everybody to work. And like I said, we had some of the toughest receivers and some of the best receivers you'll see, but they were downfield blocking. You know, I remember, like I said, Jerome Bettis, you know, being out in front blocking for me. And so they said, you know, seeing some old film of me blocking for him. Rick Meyer jumping out there on reverses blocking. Doing the little things every single play so that we can be successful.
Lake Dawson was a terrific blocker.
Oh my gosh, we called him Bam Bam. I mean, he would take defensive safeties and defensive backs and like lock up on them and drive them in the ground. I've never seen anything like that in my life.
A really good friend of mine, and one of the best guys I know, quite frankly, his name's Charles Roach. He's an attorney who graduated from Ron Colley in 85, then went to Notre Dame. And he was at that game, the 1988 game against Miami of Florida. He said it's the single greatest event in his life other than the birth of his kids. I think that's how he described it to me. Wow. He said the atmosphere of that game was just simply like nothing else. Notre Dame has so many aspects of the game day experience. The walk, obviously, the Hesburgh Library, which is Touchdown Jesus, the Golden Dome, of course, the Grotto is my favorite place. It's absolutely beautiful. And then the bookstore, which will bankrupt you if you don't go in there with a plan, yeah. Then you will leave with a significant injury. But was that game, and you've been involved in some incredible games, which you're getting ready to get into about your career, does that game still stand out to you, even though you were not a participant?
Yes. I mean, that, and you know, seeing other recruits there and just seeing the hype and the bravado of Miami, and then you see this Notre Dame team that, again, everyone was like, okay, this is Miami. They're going to come in and just roll right through them. And, I mean, not one person took down. I remember, like I said, even little Reggie Ho was like, let's go. You know, he's not going to bust the crate. But even he was jumping up and excited to see and ready to play. So you knew this game is going to be electric. And don't get me wrong, Miami did not, you know, wasn't backing down. But it did give them, I would say, a little pause that, okay, these guys are for real. And so I think it had a respect factor for the Notre Dame team.
In that documentary, the Catholics versus Convicts documentary, I think it was either Leon Searcy or Steve Walsh, the quarterback, either one or both made the point that one of the first things they noticed was how much better the Notre Dame defense was compared to previous years, particularly Zorich as a disruptor on the line.
Mm-hmm. No, this man had just these humongous hands. And this is the one of, like I said, the things that, you know, Coach Holtz from a recruiting standpoint was huge on. He was very much about the importance of speed. So he would take, and it was similar philosophy of Jimmy Johnson. You take linebacker, make him a defensive lineman. You take a defensive back, make him a linebacker. But it was about speed. And that's, you saw a lot of the improvement over those first few years was in the speed of Notre Dame's defense as well as offense and their ability to match up. You know, Todd Light was a 4-4 guy. You know, you look at Stance Magala, you know, 4-3, 4-2 to some degree. You know, so you had a lot, Pat Terrell, 4-4. You had a lot more speed in the positions that for a number of years you didn't have at Notre Dame. And that really, you know, sunk in with me because that was one of my things. Like I said, I came out of high school as a, you know, track guy, but, you know, that could play football.
Your seasons at Notre Dame, Reggie Brooks's seasons at Notre Dame, produced some of the best seasons Notre Dame's ever had. They went a total of 41-8-1. They won three bowl games, should have won all four if it wasn't for the Phantom Clip, which we will talk about.
Yeah.
They, in 1989, his freshman year, coming off a national championship, they lost only one game, and that was at Miami, but then whipped up on Colorado with the number one team in the country in the Orange Bowl. And they finished second in 1990. Notre Dame went 9-3 and lost to number one Colorado 10-9 in the Orange Bowl, finished sixth. 1991, they went 10-3, and it includes one of my all-time favorite Notre Dame games, and that's the whooping they put on Florida, who was ranked number three in the Sugar Bowl, that has the famous Lou Holtz story about the waiter who had the balls, I guess we could say, to tell Lou Holtz what's the difference between Notre Dame and Cheerios. Cheerios belongs in a bowl.
Oh, yeah. That was like, I mean, you got to understand. I'll let you finish, but.
No. You go ahead right now because it made such an impression on Holtz that he mentioned that story at the post-game interview on national television. He must have been fired the hell up.
We all were, because you got to understand, like I said, you're there for about a week. And let me say, I will say this, in terms of bowl game pageantry and activities, the Sugar Bowl was my favorite by far. And like I said, I went to two Orange Bowls, which were awesome as well, and Cotton Bowl. But like everywhere we went, so he wasn't the only one that heard that said. And you got to say, you know, SEC fans can be pretty obnoxious. I'm just going to say that. And so everywhere we went, that's all you heard. So when we would go out, you know, you go out and, you know, after practice and you go grab something to eat, anywhere we went, you know, you get the gator chomp, you know, we're going to destroy you guys. You know, that saying, what the difference between, you know, what's the difference between Notre Dame and Cheerios? I heard that no less than 50 times in the course of that week.
Well, and we should add a little context. So Notre Dame was 9-3 headed into bowl season. And under the current configuration, they wouldn't have gotten anywhere close to a Sugar Bowl. No. Florida was ranked number 3. It was one of the best teams in the country, had an amazing offense. And so the thought was, you know, Notre Dame was barely in the top 20, was in the top 20, but barely in the top 18. 20. That's right. And Notre Dame didn't deserve to be at the Sugar Bowl with Florida. And it's only because they're Notre Dame and they always get treated differently. And everyone thought Florida was, you know, quite frankly, going to put the hurt on Notre Dame. And what happened was, and I want to ask Reggie about the second half. The first half was a little eh. And then the second half, I mean, Florida was a phenomenally talented team. Notre Dame ran it down Florida's throats in the second half and won by, it was like 36-22 or 39 something, won like easily.
34, something like that. It was, and that was the thing about it. It's like going into that, guys were pissed. And so because they had just a ridiculous offense, like just, they were throwing the ball, throwing for like 400 or 500 yards a game, just crazy numbers. And so Coach Holtz employed a drop 8 and sometimes drop 9. So what that means is, like I said, you have, you know, the drop 8, you have 3 guys rushing the passer and the other 8 players dropping the coverage. And a couple of times we had 9 guys dropping the coverage and only 2 guys rushing, because Shane Matthews was basically a statue. He was not going to run anywhere. So the thought was to take away the passing lanes and we would mix up the defense. And again, they were the first half, you know, they would move the ball all the way down, but they were scoring field goals instead of touchdowns. Cause when they would get down into the red zone, we would be able to stall them. But the whole time we knew we could wear teams down. We're going to keep pounding you. Like I said, hit that sledgehammer, hitting the rock. Again, it doesn't look like you're making a dent, but you keep pounding away, and soon you'll start seeing those cracks. And again, they just wore down.
And then as a running back, you just have to be – that has to be what you live for. In the second half, Notre Dame just runs over Florida, including 2 iconic and significant runs by Jerome Bettis. And I don't think one of the commentators, it might have been Dan Dierdorf, because it was covered by ABC, said, "I guarantee you, Steve Spurrier did not think his team would lose to Notre Dame tonight."
No, and they were kind of smug too, in terms of it was an arrogance about them coming in a game like they didn't feel that we deserved to be there either.
Right? Because
you would have like during the week, you would have like these mixed team functions where you know, the pageantry, you go to different dinners and activities where both teams would be required to be at some of the functions. And we had a lot of guys on our team that were from Florida. So a lot of our Florida guys were hearing all the smack that was being talked, because we practice up to a point, then fly home, you know, for Christmas. And we would always usually have to leave out Christmas Day heading to the bowl site. So a lot of our Florida guys had been hearing, oh, well, you know, we're going to, you know, just we're going to destroy you guys. You guys don't have a chance. And so, it was the trash talking was going even before we even got to the bowl game. So you add that plus fans just everywhere we go. If we wore anything Notre Dame, they were harassing our fans. I mean, just the disrespect was next world, next level of disrespect. And it just like we were so keyed in to just we didn't want to go out and hang out anymore. We just wanted to get to the game because we were that pissed off.
Well, and the one thing I remember, and then we'll talk about your senior year and then some general conversation in the minutes we have left, but Holtz gets carried off the field. That's how big of an upset it was. And it's funny to think that because Notre Dame was riding high, so who would they be upsetting? But that, you know, that year didn't work out exactly how everyone had planned. I want to know, to the extent you can tell us, what was that locker room like after the Florida victory over Florida in the Sugar Bowl? That has to be a locker room you remember.
It was like just a release and everything. It was just a sweet release of you had been waiting for this for a whole week, you know, just getting to that point and to do it in the fashion that we did it. Needless to say, that night, there was a lot of partying going on, So we left New Orleans with sweet victory. And again, we couldn't wait to get into the locker room after the game so we could say, okay, hey, where are we going? Because we wanted to see those same fans that was talking all that mess all week long so they could hear. So who belongs in the bowl?
I hope you let them have it.
Oh, you know we did. You know we
did. Reggie's senior year is one of the greatest years, individual years especially. But a terrific team year as well. Reggie Brooks's senior season at Notre Dame, he rushed for 1,372 yards with an almost unreal 8.0 yards per carry average. He scored 13 touchdowns, was named an All-American, and finished fifth in the Heisman Trophy voting that year. Do you look at 1992 and think about how great it was individually and in terms of a team? Or do you look at that and go, frickin' Stanford, how the hell did they beat us? You had the tie against Michigan, which, you know, I remember that's one something we're going to talk about with the touchdown. But I remember Holtz going off on the sideline reporter, John Dockery, because he had the temerity to ask him about a tie. But okay, you tie Michigan at home. Okay, that happens. Michigan was a great team. But you lose to Stanford, and that's the real only blemish in a terrific Notre Dame year.
And this is where, I'm trying to be better about this, but the Stanford game just – that entire season, the run against Michigan, not the catch against Penn State. It's the loss to Stanford that resonates – the most with me, because again, I wind up, getting a hip flexor. So we were up the first half and I played through the first half and then got injured. And I just always felt like, why couldn't I get back out there and help my team? I felt like I let our guys down and just have to sit and watch things go, the fumbles, the interceptions, the bad things that happened in the second half. And not being in a position to do anything about it was just crushing, you know. And that was, you always talk about think positive. Of all the things that happened in that season, that just hovers and sits on me to this day. You know, I just felt like I let the team down because I wasn't there for them. Because that was something that always, like I said, resonated with me. We were always there for each other.
One of the things that's come through, and we've talked to several athletes, and we just recorded a podcast a few weeks ago in chronology with the airing of the podcast with three-time Indianapolis 500 winner Johnny Rutherford, who's was a terrific, terrific, generous interview. And he liked to talk about his victories, you know, and he enjoyed, you know, walking down memory lane. And then I asked him the question that I ask all athletes of his stature and yours is, you know, if you close your eyes, what comes to your mind first, the games that you won or the games that you should have won? Or in his case, the race. And he immediately took off about the 75 Indianapolis 500 that he thought he should have won and lost. That was the first thing he mentioned. And here I am talking about 92, and I kind of led you to it, but Stanford was a good team, but not a great team, and beat you, I don't know, it was like 33-16. I can't remember the exact score.
I mean, we were up 16-0 in the first half, or 16-3, and to just see the wheels fall off in the second half, I mean, it was like surreal, you know, being on the sideline and just feeling helpless to see things just go awry in a matter of a half.
Well, and Stanford was coached, I think, if my memory serves, by Bill Walsh, who coached Stanford, then coached the 49ers, and then did Notre Dame games with Dick Enberg, and then came back to the stadium and won that game. But let's not – neither of us dwell on this because we want to have a good rest of the podcast because we'll get all weepy.
Well, you remember a lot of the – except certain plays here and there. So if this didn't happen – because that was a game, again, if we could have connected on maybe one or two of the deep ball passes that were wide open that, you know, we just didn't connect on, the what ifs. I mean, that is the what if game of the century for me.
Well, let's talk about another maybe what if or not what if, since we've got you on the podcast. I remember watching this, you know, it was 30 years ago, but I remember it and just thinking, you've got to be kidding me. And that's the phantom clip call on the miracle Raghib Rocket Ismail punt return against number one Colorado in the Orange Bowl. It's your sophomore year. Colorado wins 10-9, but if the call doesn't come through, Notre Dame ends up winning that game. If you can look it up on YouTube, it's an absolutely beautiful punt return. They kick it to Rocket, which is the first thing you're just like, you can't be serious. He takes it all the way back. There's a 1% clip on the play that they shouldn't have called. What's it like being on the sidelines when you see something so unbelievably beautiful ruined by some insurance salesman who can't get out of his own way?
Well, the thing that stood out to me about that game, and particularly that play, was Rocket called it. He said, I'm taking this to the house. And, you know, again, this is – for one, we were like, how are you going to do that? Because there's no way these people are going to kick you the ball. I mean,
they kick it right to him.
Yeah, that would be the most asinine thing to do, considering that is one of the only ways that we were going to have an opportunity to win that game, is if they kick it to you. Because we always expected to have a return, you know, our block punt. We were very diligent about special teams, and that was something that Coach Oates was adamant about. We were going to be the best coach special teams or team or organization there is. We're not, I mean, we might make some mistakes, offense, defense, but we're going to be prepared to win the special teams battle. And that was always something, again, every practice, we would have two 15-minute periods of special teams where we just focused on that. And that's returns, coverage. So we were looking to block a punt, a return, you make a return. And when you got a guy like Rocket, again, you block a little harder. You do a little bit more because you know if you give him an inkling of a chance, he's going to take it to the house. Another top returner was Ricky Waters. We had guys that we expected to make returns if we just did our job. If we did our part, we're going to get in the end zone.
And in 1990, in the quote-unquote tiebreaker rivalry game against Miami at Notre Dame, Rocket takes, they kick it to him again. The Hurricanes kick it to him and he takes it back. And that's almost, if not the margin of victory, pretty close. It was a really good game, a close game.
29-20. I'm sorry.
That's right. Speaking of the Rocket and touchdowns, it was your freshman year. I was in the military. I was in the Army. And one of the great things about Notre Dame in the late 80s is my roommate, Kenny Terry, who I hope is listening to this terrific, terrific, terrific man, was a Michigan fan. And so the fact that Notre Dame owned Michigan in the late 80s when I had to deal with this guy was very, very great. It was very grateful to Notre Dame. But were you on the sidelines in Ann Arbor your freshman year when number one Notre Dame beat number two Michigan and Rocket takes back two kickoff returns?
Yes. And it was all, it was just a miserable, I don't know why Michigan was always a miserable place. It was either raining or just dreary looking. You know, it's like,
it was a horrible rainy day. It was a terribly rainy day and windy.
But that was kind of like, that was Michigan, because we had that at Michigan State too. I don't know if that's just the state of Michigan is just like dreary and depressing. So I was there. And again, and like I said, the first one, you know, we returned it. We're thinking, and be honest with you, the second one, even Coach Hose didn't think they were going to kick the ball to him.
And it was like, it was like the first Schimbeckler had been there 20 years. I mean, he'd started there in the 60s, right? But
yeah,
no kickoff return against the Michigan Wolverines in Schimbeckler's entire tenure as coach until Rocket Ismail took back two in the same game.
And that, I mean, and I think part of that was some arrogance on Michigan's part, because, you know, he had, so Coach Holtz and Bo, they've known each other for years. They were on the same staff for Woody Hayes,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had a similar philosophy and perspective and how they approached the game. And so I think it was just one of those deals where, you know, the reason they kicked it to him a second time was just arrogance. It's like, there's – because, again, you know, he was there. Michigan was always big on special teams as well. That was a big part of their game. So I just really think arrogance played into that to say, well, you know, yeah, you returned one, but there's no way you're going to be able to return two. So we're going to kick it to you again. It's like, but yeah, why would you do that?
And those two kickoff returns were the margin of victory. Without those touchdowns by the Rocket on kickoffs, Notre Dame would have lost that game. Let's talk about your senior season. There's a couple of things I want to ask you about. One is the famous unconscious touchdown where you get hit so hard that it's actually kind of scary to watch. I watched it just again last night. But you score a touchdown against Michigan unconscious, or is that overstating it, or is that an actual occurrence?
That is literally my least favorite play. Because one, I don't remember it until I saw it in meetings the next day. And two, getting knocked out is not cool.
The trainers and the medical staff or whatever, they don't play around. They rush right onto the field. Like, they immediately know, like, this isn't a normal condition.
No, actually, I face planted, you know, into the end zone. And, again, I don't remember any of that game. You know, after the game, in the post-game presser, I couldn't answer any of the questions. I'd forgotten the parts of that whole game. It was just gone. So I did go back out and finish the game, though.
I was just getting ready to say, in today's NFL or college, you wouldn't be anywhere near that field.
No, I got the smelling sauce and, you know, how many fingers, and the numbness went away because literally the whole left side of my body was numb for a while. So once the numbness subsided and I could somewhat see, there's no way I wasn't going back out there.
One of the things that your class did, and I was going to ask you about the pressure of this, is Notre Dame went undefeated against USC for 11 straight years. Your class, all 4 years you were there, beat USC. How important was it for you to keep that streak alive?
That was huge. I mean, so there were two games that were paramount, at least in my time at Notre Dame. It was the Notre Dame USC rivalry and the Notre Dame Navy game. And, you know, Notre Dame Navy was more about respect and honoring the connection between the Navy and Notre Dame, because again, for years, Navy enlisted their officer program and kept Notre Dame's doors open. So we are indebted to that series. And I know a lot of people are like, why do you keep playing that game? Because they run that option and they can get injured. Then no one can say anything bad about Navy to me, because again, I'm big on history. That game and then USC are the two, again, we can lose every game but those two. And I would be like, but losing the USC, to this day, and like I said, you can, if you ever talk to any of my kids, we have five. My wife met at Notre Dame. And to this day, I was like, we have two more going to college, and all of them know, you can go to any other school in the country, any school. And I have no problem, paying the tuition and, paying for those other schools. But I will disown you if you go to USC. It's just not acceptable.
So, a terrific Notre Dame game against USC is 1989, where USC comes to Notre Dame Stadium as winning, and then Notre Dame comes back in the second half. You're 4-0 against USC. You were 3-1 in bowl games. Should have been 4-0 if it wasn't for that awful call against the Rocket. A rival of Notre Dame's back then, which has gone by the wayside because Penn State decided to join the Big Ten. But the Notre Dame-Penn State rivalry in the 80s was as intense as anything. And quite frankly, Penn State did very, very well against Notre Dame. Your last home game as a senior is famous as the Snow Bowl, November 14th, 1992. Notre Dame's ranked number 8. Penn State is ranked number 22, but as Penn State is winning almost the whole game in horribly cold conditions, blowing snow. It's probably all the things that you thought you didn't want to leave Tulsa for. But it comes down to a touchdown catch by Jerome Bettis and a two-point conversion that lands in your feathery hands. Well, everyone thinks Reggie Brooks can't catch. No, one of the things I learned in doing research for this podcast, Reggie Brooks can catch. Reggie Brooks can't see.
Yes, that is.
Please true. Please tell that story.
So I wore glasses to class, and I wore contacts, when playing football, because again, goggles, I wasn't gonna do the Eric Dickerson thing. I just couldn't do it. Did not like that look. So I wore contacts in the game. But in practice, I wouldn't wear my contacts because they irritated my eyes. So I was like, again, this is kind of like the whole thought of, running a play with no right guard. Well, do I really need contacts while I'm practicing? You kind of do, considering, if you're going to be a part of the offense, part of that offense, you're going to get the ball thrown to you. So you might want to be able to see. So it never dawned on me that it would make sense to wear contacts in a game so I could see. Why? Don't ask me. To this day, don't know why I didn't wear them. I didn't think anything of it. I never told anybody. I just didn't wear them in practice, but I would always wear them in the game. And, I would miss balls in practice. And again, we were a running team, so I didn't really put a lot of stock in the passing game because I knew we were going to run the ball. So it's like, hey. So I was never a primary receiver in any pass route. I was out there very much more decoy than anything else. And like I said, my only other catch was in a game was against Navy, and it was for a touchdown. It was a seam route. So when I wore my contacts, could see great. And when I didn't, not so much. And so it was like, I didn't even think about it until Coach Holtz, after the game, he gets up and says, he has hands of stone. And I'm like, what? And because you practice, was a different deal and didn't resonate that, you know, I didn't have my contacts, so I didn't really mention it. So I was actually not in that progression of the two-point conversion. Literally, and Aaron Taylor will tell you, Aaron Taylor, one of the most dominant offensive linemen that we had, said he's the reason I caught that ball because he missed his block. I don't know why you – that would be your claim to fame. It's like, hey, I was the reason that we got that two-point conversion because I didn't block my man.
Well, Notre Dame's losing the whole game. Less than a minute left, they go down to Penn State's goal line. They throw a pass to Jerome Bettis, which is actually their two-point conversion play, but they used it to score the touchdown. They're down 16-15. Coach Holtz, according to what I saw and read, basically draws up a play on the sideline. Rick Meyer, and I'm going to post the clip of this play on Facebook, but Rick Meyer throws a beautiful pass. Reggie Brooks lays out for it, catches it. Notre Dame wins 17-16. One of the things that's interesting when watching that clip, especially when you watch the entire game, because NBC has their vault open and have all these great Notre Dame games on YouTube that you can see. You walk off the field with that football. Do you still have it?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. And it's at home because I'm in my office. I was looking up to see it because I have my helmet here, the trophy. But it is at the house, and it's got it inscribed, Notre Dame, Penn State, 17-16. And it doesn't say the snowball, but you'd get like a game ball. So that was the game ball for me. And the other important point of that game was that was the first senior class to leave to win their last home game in Notre Dame Stadium. And that was a bigger part of that game than anything else, is that the previous two senior classes had lost the last home game prior to their last game at Notre Dame Stadium.
That was one of the questions I had written down. Do you go into your last game at Notre Dame Stadium? I mean, you'd been there as a recruit. You had played, by the time of your senior year, you'd played probably 25 games there at least, close to that number. You're just thinking, there's no way we're going to lose my last game at the house that Rockne built.
That was the majority of the talk. I mean, within the course of the week, it was extremely important. I mean, Rick, myself, Irv Smith, our secondary was all freshmen, but Brian Radigan, Demetrius DeBose, that was a huge Junior Bryant, just thinking about the guys except our senior class. That was a huge, huge part of that game and just the tenacity. And, we talked about we could have tied the game and, ended with a tie, but there was no way. And coach knew it too. That's why he was like, hey, we're going for two. That was going to happen regardless, just because we did not, and coach knew, we could not go out without, that last home game without a win. We just, that was something that we just stuck with us because we were a part of those teams of the previous 2 years, and to see and not be able to send that senior class out on a high note, we just couldn't allow that to happen.
You go on to crush number 3, Texas A&M in the Cotton Bowl. You finished 4th. But in looking in the few minutes we have left, two of the most famous plays in the history of Notre Dame football happened in the exact same corner of the exact same end zone. What did Pat Terrell ever say to you about, hey, you trying to take my spot?
No, I said you see it. And again, when you're in the mix, in the middle of it, going through it, you don't really think about it. But to be able to step back and reflect on just the magnitude of the plays and be a part of that, be a part of that Notre Dame history and that lore, because you're talking about George Gipp, you know, Johnny Lujack, Lattner, Tim Brown, you know,
Paul Horning, Joe Montana, the list goes on.
Yeah, and you like, but that was the thing. That was the magnitude of what that playing on that surface meant. And even to this day, coming out of the tunnel, and countless guys, you know, even guys, like I said, Joe Theismann, even now coming out of Justice Allen Page, coming out of that tunnel, yeah, still resonates with guys. Yeah, you may not have been, it may have been years since you played, but to come out of that tunnel, whether you're walking out of it or running out as a player, it's something special.
Speaking of someone we'd love to have on the podcast, Allen Page, what an absolute phenomenal human being, besides football player, one of the greatest defensive players in the history of the NFL, one of the greatest players in the history of Notre Dame. But what he's done post-football is just absolutely phenomenal.
The Page Foundation is a true blessing, and he does such a phenomenal job with the young people, and it just highlights the importance of education, you know, and how the value of it is something that, again, you can't take that away. And, you know, I've had the just sheer joy and honor of communicating with him fairly regularly, just to talk. I always kind of be like, wow, because I can call up, you know, I can call up a giant John, Lattner. I can call up John Hewitt. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, I was, you know, texting with Joe Montana. And, you know, when you're doing it, you're like, you know, because, again, with my role, it's about outreach and make sure guys are connected. But that's what's special about Notre Dame. It's the people. And these are the same individuals that are just icons. But to have the ability to speak to them on a personal level and just get to know them as human beings, you get to see a different side of them that, you know, humanizes them, but also lets you know, this is what I'm a part of.
And it must have been important maybe not when you first go to Notre Dame, but as your career progresses at Notre Dame, to be conscious of that legacy. And I'm going to say it, this is how they would say it in the Army, right? Like, don't be a knucklehead. Like, you do understand that if you're here, you're representing Tim Brown, you're representing, you know, Bob Golic, you're Joe Montana, Dave Casper, Allen Page, Bob Kuchenberg. I mean, Joe Theismann, too many people to name. Does that not weigh on you, but is it something that you factor in? You're like, look at the people who came before us, what they mean to the community at large, and I can add to that legacy, and I want to.
That's exactly the point, is like, you know, you don't want to let those guys down because they set a standard. And it's not so much that you have to live up to it. Just don't bring it down. Don't be the one to cause shame or you know, bringing that legacy down. And it's not so much a pressure as it is an honor, you know? And it's not just the former players. I look at Father Hesburgh.
Exactly.
And the you know, what he has done, what he did for so many, that was a part of the fabric of Notre Dame as a community. And being a part of that community goes beyond being a playing a game. Because in the end, that's what you're doing. You're playing a game. But life, you know, life happens. And to see, you know, you see these individuals go out and do great things beyond their playing career. I marvel at the work that Jerome does with, you know, the Bus Stops Here Foundation, Justin Tuck and what he does with his literacy, Rush Literacy, and, you know, Golden Tate and the focus on, you know, veteran, you know, helping veterans. Same thing with Brady Quinn. It's that's where the rubber meets the road, not the success that you had as an athlete, but who are you as a person? What are your values? And that's what you were taught at Notre Dame, to take to step it up, not only on the field, but in your life, your personal life, spiritual life, and but also giving back to others, because that's what you were made to do.
Your career, last question before we end with the final five questions we ask of anyone. Your career is bookended by two of the most famous seasons in Notre Dame history, the 1988 National Championship team and the 1993 team that is one field goal against Boston College away from winning the national championship again, we would think. But that's the famous year where they beat Florida State, which ironically, when it came to the final rankings, the only game that didn't matter to the pollsters was the game that Notre Dame beat number one Florida State.
You know?
Did you ever go like, damn, how come I missed out? I mean, is that just kind of the accident of birth where you would think, man, that's if I'd gotten there a year earlier, or I'd gotten there a year later, maybe that would have made a difference.
Well, and that's why I think the Stanford game resonates so prominently with me, is that, you know, I still feel we should have won at least one more national championship during that period when I was there, because, you know, you see all these opportunities and a lot of these same guys, you know, the Brian Youngs, the Pete Bursiches, the Jim Flanagans, you know, the Brian Hamiltons, I mean, that came in on the back end, the Tom Carters, the Jeff Burses, you know, you had all these, the, you know, Derek Mays,
Aaron Taylor.
Had these really talented guys on the back end. It's like that you played with that, man, our senior year, of the 22 starters, you know, 17 or 18 went to the NFL. You know, our offensive line, you had Tim Ruddy, you had Justin Hall, Aaron Taylor, Jordy Halter, Lindsey Knapp, Irv Smith, Oscar McBride, Lake Dawson, Rick Meyer, you know, myself, Ray Zellers. On defense, you had Brian Young, Brian Hamilton, Demetrius DeBose, Carmel McGill, Devon McDonald, Jeff Burris, John Covington, you know, Tom Carter. All these guys went to the league, you know, and a tie and a loss. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Should not have happened.
And I completely get it. I mean, I've never played anything at a professional level or even close from an athletic standpoint. But you know what? I can remember racquetball games I lost in 2001, 15, 14, like they were yesterday. And someone's like, dude, it's club racquetball. And I'm like, whatever. Do you keep score or not?
Yeah. Exactly.
I could not imagine, you know, having the sorts of defeats that athletes at your level, professional and amateur, have to deal with. Obviously, you know, like I said, these folks that we've talked to so far, that's the ones they bring up. That's what they remember. We end the podcast, the Leaders and Legends podcast, and we're with Reggie Brooks with the same five questions for everyone. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
What was your first job?
it didn't last very long, but I was in high school. I worked in a movie theater. So I was one of the, again, I took tickets and cleaned out the movie theater after the people left. I stayed for about 2 weeks, but they were on their feet too long. I was like, I got to sit down. This is just, you know, this is not for me.
What was your first concert?
Actually, first concert was by accident. This is I was in college and went to a Prince concert. And was
that's good.
And be honest with you, I was not a huge Prince fan, but wow. I mean, a phenomenal concert. Was going, you know, just to hang out with some friends. I said, well, you know, I'll go. I mean, don't have anything else to do. I was doing the spring break. And I mean, just a phenomenal concert. And this is when, like I said, the lead act would perform for more than 30 minutes.
That's a terrific first concert. If you could recommend, question number three, if you could suggest any book for someone to read, which book would you recommend?
Well, I'm more into the fantasy, but nonfiction. But there's this one book I read, and this is a while back, Boys in the Boat. It's a book about rowing and, you know, the importance of everybody in the boat. If you only think about it, it was an eight man boat, and they're rowing and, you know, going. And this is the rowing in the Olympics at in Germany. Mm-hmm. But there, it talks about their life through and how, again, the importance of everybody in the boat. And again, if you're rowing, you have to be in lockstep with everybody. And you, because if you get any sort of drag or anything is in the least bit off, it will just slow you down. And just the precision that it takes and everybody being on the same page, from the coxswain to each, and the difference between the guy in the front and the guy in the back of the boat, it goes through all of that, but it also goes to their lives as they go on in the army and in the service and their families. Mm-hmm. But they always come back to this boat, being one of the eight in this boat and winning the championship, and the sacrifice and the commitment that it took to get there, and how it impacted their lives years later. And that book has just, it just resonated with me to no end. Our rowing coach, Martin Stone, hit me to the book. And this guy's, you know, rowers are a different breed. So, you know, I was kind of skeptical about it, but after reading it, I mean, I just ate it up.
And what's the name of the boat? Boys in the Boat. Boys in the boat. Number four, if you could witness any event in history, be there as it happens, which event would you choose?
That's a good one. I'd have to say the crucifixion. I know this sounds kind of morbid, but just to witness the gift of life given, and have a better understanding of my faith, of this is why you do what you do, and the faith that you have in mankind is because Christ gave his life for me. And to be there to witness that, to get the full impact of it, I think would just be phenomenal.
Terrific. Last question of the five questions. If you could have dinner with anyone living today, 2 hours off the record, just to chat, whom would you choose?
I would say Michelle Obama. You know, I know she just her strength, her quiet confidence, and just her intelligence, and just, you know, just hearing her speak and her humility as an individual, her focus as being a mom, and the importance of not wanting to be in the limelight. I always, you know, you have people that like to be in the limelight. That was never me. But to talk to somebody at such a high level, but that maintain their humanity and compassion and dignity, it always, something that's always resonated with me, and someone when I'd love to just talk to over dinner.
You have been listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, Garmond Construction, the Crown Plaza Hotel and Grand Hall and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, the law firm of Bowes, McKinney, and Evans, and the Bowes Public Affairs Group, the McGinleys, Golden Ace Inn, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. Our guest today has been All-American and Notre Dame great, and I guess I should say, because we didn't get to ask you about this on the podcast, 2-time winner of the Madden Bowl, Mr. Reggie Brooks. Reggie, it's been an honor. I loved every second of it. I wish we could talk for a much longer time. I have so many more questions, but I know we both have other things to do. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you for being everything that Notre Dame is all about.
Thank you so much for having me. And again, we don't have to be on the podcast. Keep in touch and, you know, continue the conversation. Would love to.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.